The book Fast Minds isn't about people with ADHD, it's for people with ADHD. The book's subtitle is How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. Its author, psychiatrist Craig Sermon of the Harvard Medical School, was on Focus last March talking in a practical way about how attention deficit hyperactivity disorder works and the best ways to cope with it. Medication is an important part of the treatment picture, but not the only part. There are many other alternative therapies and techniques that don't involve medicine. I'm Jim Meadows. Today, an encore presentation of Focus, Craig Sermon talks about ADHD. Our program continues after the news. Good morning, I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. We're not taking calls this hour, but we'll be back live tomorrow at 10 a.m. on WYLL AM 580. Diagnosing and treating ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, has been a source of some discussion and even controversy over the years. And my guest today may have something to say about that. But one thing Dr. Craig Sermon says is that for adults, ADHD is a condition that can be identified, treated, and managed, and the patient can have a big say in how to go about it. Dr. Sermon is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and scientific coordinator for the Adult ADHD Research Program at Harvard's Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also the author, along with Dr. Tim Bilkey and health journalist Karen Weintraub, of Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. It's published by Berkeley Books. And Dr. Sermon, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And just as a question for starters, what's the most succinct definition of ADHD you can give?
So ADHD is a neurodevelopmental condition. The new psychiatric criteria are coming out in May. And it's been moved from disruptive behavior into neurodevelopmental, which makes a lot of sense. It's a lifelong condition where people have difficulty controlling how they engage themselves. And it's confusing because in kids, you can see a wide array of patterns, impulsivity, hyperactivity, troubles with focus. In adults, you tend to see more problems related to focus. So the way that I see it in adults primarily is difficulty controlling what you're focusing on.
Well, I'm wondering, I understand the name ADHD was adjusted as recently as the 1990s. Is the H,
true,
the hyperactivity, an appropriate word when talking about the condition in adults?
It's less appropriate. In fact, you see about 1% of adults that have only hyperactivity issues. Adults grow out of a lot of their misbehavior. If an adult is running around our waiting room at the hospital and climbing on things, I'm likely to have to call somebody about an emergency situation. That's very different with a child. You expect that kind of behavior. So the control improves as we get older. And what you tend to see is less sort of behavior, impulsivity, hyperactivity issues as people get older. But the category is sort of a lump category of focus problems, impulsivity, hyperactivity. And the main reason is that it's inherited that way. You can have a parent who has hyperactivity in their history with a child who's never had hyperactivity. And the treatments that we use really help both kinds of presentations. So it gets lumped all together.
I'm wondering, we talk about ADHD as a collection of behaviors. You use the word neuro as a neurodevelopmental condition. Is it something that we can see some way physically in the brain and the nervous system or in how it operates? Or are we just not there yet?
We're there. In the last decade, it's very exciting. You can take pictures of the brain as it's actively working. You can give people tasks, for example, that require focusing while they're doing the task, and you can see which parts of the brain light up and which don't. What's been confusing in ADHD is just as people have different kinds of challenges, whether it's, you know, impulsivity or focus issues, you know, as they grow up, you actually see different regions of the brain being different in different people. there are some regions that are commonly involved, and they are regions that we've known for a long time to be very important in ability to pay attention and sort of control yourself, control behavior.
Dr. Sirman, do we know what causes ADHD?
It's a mix. Genetics accounts for a good chunk, but there's also some environmental factors that are still a little unclear. Some of the factors, like, for example, trauma as people are born to the head or lead poisoning really should be called something else, but you don't always know sort of what the scene of the crime, so to speak, was. And the regions that I talked about that are different in people with ADHD are very vulnerable to, you know, sort of trauma and to problems. But what's fascinating is that you'll see, you know, very high rates, for example, of twins, where both, you know, of the pair of identical twins have ADHD. But it's not 100%. You get rates of about 70% of both twins having ADHD. So what's different about that 30% where there's a mismatch? And it's got to be some kind of nurture effect, you know, how people are raised, how they cope, how they adapt in life. And that's really where I think our attempts to educate people come in. It's not as simple as pick a drug off a shelf and that's your option for ADHD. I think people find lots of different ways of adapting and thriving to these very common traits.
So are you saying it may be somewhat inherited and genetic, but also somewhat a learned behavior?
Well, I would say that it's more about learning how to compensate for the issue. One way to put it is that often I'll ask people if there's parts of their life that go just fine. And you can get stories like, well, I spend lots of time on Facebook and, you know, people seem to like me on it. And, you know, you may not get paid for that kind of behavior. It may be rewarding. Do too much of it, it's a problem. So, you know, there are some activities that people can do very well. And sometimes it's, you know, one kind of job versus another. Gosh, you know, when I was on a team, you know, we had challenges and, you know, I was making money based upon my sales going from, you know, client to client on the road. That was great. But then you compare it to another environment, like I got my promotion. I have to sit at a desk. I have to sit in meetings. You know, I really struggled before to do my expense accounts, you know, never filed them. Company doesn't care about that, less money out of their coffer. But right now it's the quarterly reports I'm supposed to finalize and present, and I'm just scrambling. I'm not on top of things. I'm struggling. So you'll see people cope better in one environment than another, and I think that this is a clue to why some people sort of suffer more with these traits than others. It's part of it's being born with, you know, compensatory abilities, but part of it's finding something as simple as a job you actually like.
I'm wondering there when you talk about being able to cope and compensate, it's not a matter of these, at least that's what it sounds like you're saying, it's not a matter that the behaviors associated with ADHD can be a strength in some cases, but that the patient is just able to compensate or cope better in some settings.
Well, that's a fascinating discussion, and there's people who feel very strongly that their ADHD traits, you know, help them. I see ADHD traits themselves as a style, but ADHD as a diagnosis to me, you know, is a medical condition. And the major difference is, does it cause impairment? Meaning, you know, are people not thriving in their life? Is it impacting the relationships, or they're not getting paid as much? And you see this in the data. People, you know, are less likely to be married. There's more sort of tension with other people. Or they're not making as much money, or they repeat jobs more often, or they're going back to college for the third time to try at community college, you know, where their peers just seem to go right through. And what's different about me? I hang out with these guys. They seem to be able to do it. I can't. So there's a diagnosis where it's impairing, but some people really find a way to minimize that impairment is sort of what I'm emphasizing.
Does ADHD occur differently among different groups of people, cultures, ages, genders, any sort of grouping?
This is a great question, and it's very interesting because in the digital age, you know, people say you're bombarded with, you know, potential distractions all the time. There's a universe of diversion, you know, a click away on the internet. So isn't this just a product of too much to handle for our, you know, poor brains? One really nice study has done, you know, a look at rates of attention deficit across 10 countries and what are the factors that were involved. And, you know, this analysis, which was, I believe, back in 2007, showed that you see similar rates, this is in adults, of ADHD, you know, somewhere around 4% of the population. I mean, it varied from 3 to 5, depending upon what country was being looked at. But you can't explain it if you do a sub-analysis by, you know, for example, socioeconomic status, which means sort of how much people earn or whether they're in urban environments or less urban environments. You know, these are factors that might help you understand, is it just access to technology and, you know, people who are bombarded with, you know, the demands of, you know, living in a, you know, cutthroat, you know, corporate, you know, urban environment.
So it's not a matter of, say, if somebody is living in very primitive, simple conditions, maybe even a hunter-gatherer culture, if you go looking for that sort of thing, it's not going to be a case for them that there is no such thing as ADHD or that is not a relevant diagnosis for them.
Well, the data so far supports that it cuts across countries, conditions, peoples. What I think people haven't looked at, though, is what I'm trying to emphasize before, and I think is so critical to the individual hearing this and saying, yeah, you know, well, lots of people have trouble with focus and organization. Some people learn to manage it more than others. And for some people, it's about medication to change the brain conditions, and that's really what they need to do. For other people, it may be figuring out, you know, the right environment, as I was emphasizing, or some strategies that are going to help them. And the way that I think about it, I think there are some situations where it's good to have some of these traits. For example, this hunter-gatherer, you know, idea that you present has been proposed. Tom Hartman wrote a neat book called, you know, about the hunter-gatherer hypothesis about why ADHD exists. And if you think about it, society probably still needs people who respond to things around them, you know, can quickly shift from one thing to another. These may be useful categories in a protector or a hunter. But it also needs people who can just sit and focus and persist, and this is better for maybe rearing children and cooking food or, you know, or basket weaving, you know, for example. I mean, this so society benefits from having all of these traits. The issue is that these traits are distributed through the whole population that we see in ADHD, and it just turns out some people get a lot of them. And if you get a lot of them, it's going to mean that it's a special situation that you fit well into.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking today about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with Dr. Craig Sermon of Harvard Medical School, and he heads up the Adult ADHD Research Program at Harvard's Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. You're the co-author of a book called Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. And one thing that struck me about the book is that it doesn't talk about ADHD, as a lot of people might, as something that happens to other people, which automatically sort of would put a stigma around the condition. This is something that just people can have.
Absolutely. The introduction to our book was written by Howie Mandel, who's a very public figure, you know, from his work back in St. Elsewhere and Deal or No Deal and hosting shows currently on the air. And, you know, you see ADHD in people who are actually very successful and very prominent. And as he articulates in the introduction, he feels that his impulsivity traits when he was a kid meant that he didn't complete school. You know, he figured out, obviously, his way to thrive, but this is a condition that cuts across sort of, you know, I think society. And one thing that it's sometimes confusing is that many people have some of these traits. And what we contend is that the lessons learned from helping people with ADHD can help anybody who finds themselves scattered or having difficulty following through and completing things. I'll go through the acronym if it's useful.
Sure.
Fast Minds is a title, but it stands for forgetful, achieving below potential, stuck in a rut, time-challenged, motivationally challenged, impulsive, novelty-seeking, distractible, and scattered. And if people have had these kinds of issues lifelong, not just their current job, not just in their current relationship, then it's very likely that it's worth talking with a professional and getting some resources around ADHD.
And I'm wondering, that's something to bring up the question of how severe, how can you, when you're looking at something so subjective, know whether or not you're dealing with something that's really serious or not? And how, what's the danger when thinking about this of suggestibility? I'll tell you, a few years ago, I read a book about sociopaths. And for a short time, I was looking around people and thinking, could that person be a sociopath? They
right.
seem to have all these.
Right.
And
right.
until I realized right. that it was ridiculous. This is ADHD is a lot less severe in a different sort of condition. But if you're thinking about that, it may be possible to see that in a lot of people more so than what would warrant a diagnosis.
So I really think you want to get good advice and good a good process, I'd say, with you know, going and using books like ours, using CHAD, for example, the Children and Adults with ADD has a great website, and trying to think about, you know, does this set of traits explain challenges in my life? You know, what kind of difference would it make if it was easier for me to focus on things, stick with things, follow through, be more organized? Now, people will be listening to that and saying, gosh, you know, there's all these pressures on me. I'm supposed to perform and outcompete. And, you know, of course it would help if I was all of those things. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about sort of the deep sense of frustration that many people have, that they just haven't been able to perform the way that they feel like they should. And the thing in the way is this difficulty with focus and follow through. It's absolutely true that people can hear a condition and think, oh, gee, that's me. And, you know, and what if that's me? We want people to just sort of to know, you know, that's me. There's a home for me. Finally, someone else is talking about what I've dealt with my whole life.
And I just looked up the website that you mentioned for children and adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It is at chad.org. That's C-H-A-D-D .org. And I'll try to make sure to repeat that again later in the hour. I'm wondering about some of the traits, and maybe you can go into them at greater detail, but some of the traits for ADHD don't seem to be similar at first glance. Well, you might think, how can a condition that causes impulsive behavior also cause procrastination? Or how can a desire for new stimulus be matched with a short temper?
So we have systems in our brain that help us choose what we're going to do, control what we're going to do. And a lot of this is conscious, but a lot of other parts of it are really unconscious. So, you know, for example, right now you're listening to us on the radio. And you might be thinking about something about, you know, what you had for lunch or what yesterday or what you're going to have for dinner tonight, or, you know, it could be anything, you know, where you're going, what exit to take if you're driving. There's just a universe of possible things you could even just think about, let alone do. So what controls what we do when? Well, it turns out it's a very sort of sophisticated system in our brain that involves multiple regions in the brain. And you can actually see these different regions as they work. You know, when you give people choices and decisions to make as you're looking at them in a brain scanner. And it's very clear that whether it's impulsivity or, you know, restlessness physically or troubles with focus, yes, there's some different regions that are involved with the brain, but it does come down to this kind of, you know, control module, if you will, that sort of helps people decide what to do when. Our prefrontal cortex, which is the most forward part of our brain, many people claim, and I agree, differentiates us from all other species, other animals. It's developed as humans have developed evolutionarily, and it allows planned, you know, behavior and choices. At the same time, there's sort of a constant monitoring system that, for example, filters out extraneous sounds and noises, so you can hear the sounds of our voices right now, that allows you to target something you're looking at, you know, while you're listening to us, as opposed to just, you know, having a flood of visual information be a blur to your brain. So there's a lot of selection that our brains are doing all the time. And some of this, again, is conscious. I am going to read this. I'm going to listen to this. And that's the choice part of it. That's a conscious choice. But some of it is just about, you know, how tight the control system is. To use a car metaphor, you know, if you choose to turn the wheel, you can kind of have loose steering or tight steering, a very reliable ability to, you know, turn and achieve a certain position of your car. And the same is sort of, it's a good metaphor for ADHD, I think, because there's something loose in the system with ADHD. The mind's going to wander despite the intention of, you know, trying to accomplish some task or think about something without something else popping up.
Well, we have a caller coming in from the road, so let's get him while he's still in range. And Ron on I-57, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Morning. And I am driving hands-free, so in case people wonder if I'm
That's
talking
good.
On a cell phone, I'm hands-free, using both hands on the wheel. I'm 61 years old, and about a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with adult ADD, and it was really interesting because I had never thought about that as any possibility, but in hindsight, looking back over, you know, my life, I can see now where a lot of things that have gone on in my life and a lot of things that I've wondered about, you know, are answerable because of learning about this. Mine is mild enough, I guess, that the doctor who diagnosed me said there really wasn't any reason at this time in my life to start medication or to do anything about it as far as aggressively treating it. But, you know, he was thought that it would explain a lot of things that have gone on in my life, and it has.
So that understanding can be so helpful to people because people blame themselves. I'm not sure if you feel like you have for things that are really just about how you're wired.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, I haven't accomplished in a life. I find it hard to focus. And as I've gotten older, it seems that it's gotten worse, which I guess is, you know, goes hand in hand with the natural aging process. So, you know, I'm really interested in reading your book and wondering, you know, if you run into people like me, I mean, what do you tell them now in your practice? And do you still, you know, are you still researching adults with, you know, ADD or ADHD?
Doctor, I think maybe part of the question there is if you're older and you've really been coping with it for some time, are there particular things you would particular ways you would approach it at that stage in life?
I'm always asking if there's problems because of the traits. And people get confused. ADHD is this gamish of things. Are we talking about how I feel? What I want to know is on a symptom rating scale, and you can find them online at the CHAD website, for example, or in our book and other books like it, you know, do these traits mean that one is struggling, that one is putting in extra hours, that one's not as reliable as one wants to be, that, you know, you're spending a lot of time, you know, compensating, that the compensatory effort is just profound for some people. And that burden is often missed because people obviously have gotten by somehow. But what's the effort taken? And so people sometimes will say, okay, well, you're doing well enough. And I really look into that deeply, and I ask someone, how much time do you spend keeping track of things or hunting for stuff? You know, how often do you have to just really be very, very careful about reminder systems? And I always want to know, is this a burden? So it's not just like the glaringly obvious problems.
Well, it has been, and I think it answers a lot of things. Like it took me 26 years to finish my bachelor's degree, and I've been ABD in a doctoral program now for almost a decade, and it's always been easy to stay focused and accomplish the things that really pique my interest. But when I get into areas that aren't as much fun, then it's really hard to stay involved with them or to want to come back to them.
Well, I'm really glad you called in.
That's a struggle.
I'm very pleased you called in because I think people get all sorts of advice from people. But what you really want to know is there impairment due to these traits and how much of a difference would it make for me? There's a lot of factors that go into success in life. And, you know, I think when people are older, they've tried different sort of strategies and environments. And one other question I like to ask people is, where have you thrived? Where have things worked as well as they ever have for you? And did you still have those traits then? Because it can get confusing. Sometimes it's actually anxiety or depression or really just a bad relationship with a boss that, you know, produces scatter and these kinds of traits.
Well, it was actually while, you know, seeing someone about depression, among other things, that, you know, this diagnosis was made. And, yeah, I've never felt like I've ever accomplished as much as I should have and could have in my life. So, yeah, there's always been a sense of, you know, of not living up to my potential, and which leads to a sense of failure to a large extent. So, yeah, I'd say it's had a really drastic impact on, you know, how I view things, my own self-image. So, yeah, it's as well as you know what it's done, but just the way it's caused me to view myself, which is something I don't know if kids get into, but it certainly has impacted me.
Well, I think it's so important that people understand that this is similar to like the hair color of your hair. People are wired different ways to function different ways. And if you don't realize that, people end up blaming themselves. And one of the things that we say in the book is whatever you can do to blame, you know, attention deficit disorder, if that's what you have, versus blame yourself, gives you an opportunity to actually work on strategies with your mental energy as opposed to beating yourself up. And that's not an easy transformation. But just in the very, you know, introduction to your comments, I really appreciate your calling in, because this awareness is sort of like, oh, wow, you know, gosh, it's not just me. You know, it's not only is it not just you, it's 1 in 20 people have these kinds of, it's hard to fit in and succeed the way that society kind of supports and expects.
Well, I really appreciate your time and your comments, and I look forward to reading the book. Thank you very much.
Ron, thank you very much for calling in. And there are a couple of questions I wanted to ask you, Dr. Sermon, following up on Ron's call. But first, I'd like to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment with more about ADHD with Dr. Craig Sermon. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program. We're back with Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore edition of Focus. We're not taking live phone calls this hour, but we welcome your feedback on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're talking today about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, with an expert, Dr. Craig Sermon, co-author of the new book, Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might. Dr. Sermon, I was thinking about your conversation with Ron on the phone from earlier, and about just some of the compensating things that people do just to cope with the conditions of ADHD. What do you prescribe for them besides what they've already been doing on their own in terms of coping mechanisms, especially when we're talking about things you can do besides medication?
So the issue of whether to take medication or not for ADHD is a very personal one. I do believe that if people have very strong ADHD traits and a lot of life problems because of it, medication is just such a transformative tool. And whenever we talk about coping strategies and things that people can try, things that people can practice, I always want to understand sort of, you know, two things. One, can people do homework, so to speak, in their life? And I'm not just talking about a student, you know, getting an assignment in class and then do they follow through on it. I mean, if someone has a real plan, they sit down and they say to a friend, hey, look, you know, I'm going to reorganize, you know, my office. What's the ability to actually do that? And then the other thing I want to understand from people is, are there things that have maximized the ability to make personal change and, you know, follow through? So in other words, what's this track record with homework and what's helped homework happen? And one reason this is so important is that in our behavioral therapy studies, if you give people a number of strategies to try, and I'll mention some of those, you're just giving them more homework. And if there's someone who's already procrastinating and not following through or even forgetting that they had any homework to begin with, which is all part of having ADHD traits, then you're just adding to their frustration. So there's a subset of people, I think, who really can adopt new strategies and don't need the medication support. And it really is the people who can do homework.
I want to ask you more about those strategies and also about the use of medication. We have another caller in on the road. Let me say hello to Frank on I-57. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, I've got a question. Is there an overlap between ADHD and behaviors on the autism spectrum? Because I'm a retired teacher and had worked with children that had both diagnoses and was wondering how similar and how dissimilar those different conditions are and how they manifest themselves.
It's a wonderful question. I think when you know somebody who's not behaving the way other people are, and then you try to figure out, okay, and I try to do this professionally, what condition do they fall into? Things can look kind of similar. And it's not just, a sort of autism versus ADHD. It could also be learning disabilities that produce problems not participating, for example, in a classroom where you worked. And the fundamental difference, I think, between different conditions is what's causing the symptoms. So attention deficit, more or less, is a problem with control of following through on intention. I intend to sit still, but I can't. I intend to listen, but my mind's off somewhere else. I intend to not send impulsive emails to my boss, but gee, look at me, go do this again. In the autism spectrum, the fundamental difference, I believe, is not so much about the control. It's about ability to understand another person's mind and where they're coming from and share in life in a mutual way. So they don't step into other people's shoes well, which means they don't know how their actions impact other people. They don't read the recommendations from the classroom and from the kids' behavior around them the same way other people do. So it's much more about those kinds of reasons.
So some of that, you're talking about empathy?
True, right. So one way that we talk about this in psychology is theory of mind. Can we all sort of imagine other people just in the microseconds that we're interacting? We have to have some idea of what it means to say something to somebody and how they're going to react. And so if people can't sort of, walk in other people's shoes and, again, have, as you put it, empathy for another person, that's very different than, having empathy but impulsively blurting something out and looking like you don't.
Okay, well, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you very much. Let me ask you a little bit about the strategies that people can use in relation to ADHD, the ones that you said, I guess, work more if you're able to essentially do homework on them.
So we like to think that what matters is that people figure out the strategies for them. And we built our book this way. You'll see books that have three steps to a more organized life. And I think that's very frustrating for people who with some of the traits that we see in the clinic, in the ADHD spectrum. And instead, we think there's some principles for what works well for an ADHD brain, things like managing distraction. And it's not just the things around people that are hard to filter out, sound, noise, clutter on the desk. Good to get those out of sight, out of mind. But it's also the thoughts that pop up in the mind, ways that people distract themselves. It could be because they're worried. It could be just because their mind produces popcorn thoughts, as we put in the book. So we suggest that people have some way of managing distractions. And with thoughts that pop up, it's been very powerful for people to have one place they put those thoughts. I'm trying to write a paper, and I keep thinking about blah, blah, blah. So I write it down. And then I just know it's written down. The next thing that pops up, I write down. And then if you have some time to manage those thoughts later, even if it's just feelings that are popping up, I think it's very helpful. Another major theme is that if people have trouble with organization, people should pick their battles. I don't think some people run on very rigid schedules and can schedule every 15 minutes. And I have patients like that who schedule out their life and they follow a script, like they're actors in a movie all day long. But the majority of people I see with organizational challenges really need to pick their battles and pick, a critical moment is what I would call it, that's going to really matter. So stepping back and saying, gosh, I'm tired every day. I'm not getting to bed on time. What's the critical moment where things go wrong? Is it when I, leave the lights on and I'm on my computer again after dinner? Is it, should I really just like get ready for bed as soon as possible and have a rule for myself that I'm not going to, turn any sort of electronic devices on or watch any TV? I'm just going to record all my shows for the weekend. Now, all this takes discipline, but you want to have a game plan for what's going to have a big impact in sort of reorganizing your day.
Very interesting. Let me go to another caller. Good morning to Tammy in Champaign. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, yes. So I just wanted to know if you had any advice for someone who was trying to encourage an adult to maybe look into if they have this, if they have it or not. I've got an older sibling who just seems can never really get anything accomplished. And I kind of wonder, because some of the things that you're talking about sound similar to him, but also, have you ever heard people ask if, you know, people with ADD could also be construed as having kind of narcissistic tendencies in some way, where it seems like maybe they aren't able to control their behavior, and from the outside it just kind of looks like selfishness? So I'm wondering if I'm misinterpreting some of his behavior and the way that he has relationships with, you know, friends and family. So
this is I hear two questions here. One is, how do you talk to someone you care about to help them think about this and getting support for it? And then also, how do you tell if it's ADHD or something else? And I think for the first question, I'm really interested in people reducing their fear. And the biggest fear that people have is really fundamentally, nothing's going to help the situation. Why would I bother looking into it? And, you know, and this, I think, underlies a lot of the reasons that people are uncomfortable with, you know, trying a treatment or looking for help. And it's different what helps that in different people, but I think just good information is really important. And, you know, just handing someone a book like ours, or that, you know, directing people to the CHAD website, you know, helping people understand that people who, you know, at least one person who runs an airline, you know, Howie Mandel, supposedly people like Einstein and Michelangelo, who knows? I mean, I haven't interviewed those folks. I mean, but, you know, can all have these traits. What matters is, to me, there are tools to support people with these challenges, and just get the information, make your own decision. I look at, you know, life as an experiment in adapting. And the one thing that makes us different from other animals is that we use tools. And if these tools are available, you know, why would you, you know, continue and not use them? And sometimes people do, based upon just, you know, their principles and how they feel about themselves. I don't have a fundamental problem with that, but I want them informed. The other question is, you know, could personality traits, like you mentioned, narcissism, make people feel like they don't care and they're not going to follow through on things, you know, and actually it's not ADHD. And that's absolutely true, and it can be very hard to understand the difference. I think fundamentally the difference, similar to the difference from autism or Asperger's or other kinds of conditions, is, you know, what's driving the issue? What's a person's intention is a question that I ask a lot. Is a person concerned about how they come across? And you get people who are very defended, you know, meaning that, you know, oh, it doesn't matter, because they don't have any hope that things can be different. And you have to sit with those people. And what I tend to always think about is, how hard is life for them? How much effort does it take? If, for example, if I ask someone with ADHD who's sort of defended and sort of proud, you know, and you know, how often do you lose things? They might say to me, I'm not a child. You know, I know my wife referred me here because our kid is ADHD, but I'm not like Johnny. You know, I don't lose things. It's much better for me to approach them by saying something like, how much effort does it take for you to keep track of stuff, and talk with them about the effort, as opposed to labeling problems? I think that's a very difficult way to talk with people.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
And we have an email in, and I understand, Dr. Sermon, that you work mostly with and do research on adults. This is actually a question from Kate concerning children. And she writes, how soon can ADHD be diagnosed? My 3-year-old son appears more active and impulsive than his peers, but I wonder if this behavior is still within the range of normal for 3-year-old males. At one point, should we seek professional help? Can we avoid medication with early intervention?
The short answer is that if someone is developmentally struggling, meaning they're off the normal curve of gaining skills socially, learning to communicate, controlling their behavior, then, and it can be attributed to ADHD symptoms, then an individual will benefit significantly from treatment. So just as you do a growth curve with your pediatrician, they look at height and weight and where you fall in terms of percentiles, we think it's important to experts tend to think that it's important to look at where is a person falling in terms of their ability to, you know, thrive in other ways and just basically function in life. The earlier we're talking, the harder it is to differentiate ADHD from normal. And this is part of why the diagnostic criteria that were used in the United States for the last, 20, 30 years have looked at onset by the age of 7 for criteria. But the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, has some guidance about earlier onsets, and there are situations where it makes a profound difference to treat. One of the concerns that people have is, will medications like stimulants that are often used for ADHD affect growth? And this is another place to come back to that growth chart and make sure that people are actually, staying on their growth curve in terms of actual growth too. So there's very real clinical decisions to be made, but the bottom line is, what's the opportunity cost? Is it individual struggling to grow as they're normally going to?
So in the case of a parent with a 3-year-old, should they look into it at this point?
So I think if there's extremes of disruption in behavior and all sorts, and absolutely, they should talk with their pediatrician and say that perhaps they want to meet with a child psychiatrist or someone who really specializes in these kinds of concerns. I don't think that the average primary care physician is in a position to make a good decision about whether it's a good choice, and I think people really should get good information about this. It's clear that there's the same risks of treating preschoolers to some extent, but we don't know completely. There haven't been a lot of studies, and they're out in the population. There aren't as many individuals who were treated before the age of 7 just because of the way the diagnosis is done. So to some degree, it's a gray area that people want to get, I think, thoughtful and feedback from.
And Kate was asking if you intervene early, can you avoid medication as far as ways of possible treatment?
So it's very important. The guidance has been that behavioral therapies are really important, especially when individuals are younger and developing their own organizational skills. So if you think about it, we have to learn how to get along, how to be social. And if the biggest problem, for example, is the teacher feels that child's not manageable in class, is that fundamentally, ADHD issues, or the individual hasn't, learned, social skills yet? There can be lots of different reasons why behavioral supports, education is more important in a younger individual. So first line approach is meeting with parents, clinicians to meet with parents, educate them. Parents should educate themselves, should look at the environment the child is in. Is there some way to tailor it to the individual? Cues, reminders, making sure that kids are paired up the right way, separated from overstimulating friends, for example, that school resources like paraprofessionals are applied where possible. There's so much you can do, especially in classroom settings, that should all be poured on and when really young kids. To see if it helps before medication is given. At the same time, there's very fascinating evidence that brain maturation, the way the brain looks, if you were treated with medicine, may be somewhat more normal. There may actually be some kind of normalizing effect on brain development. It's very hard to prove this, but the opposite hasn't been shown, for example, that medication treatment damages the brain. But this data comes from individuals who were treated later, not from early on. And, what I always want to know is, what's the evidence? Is there good evidence for this? Has it been done in lots of people before? And the earlier you go, the answer is, that's less and less true. So you really want things that have very little risk. But the risk of not treating, if the kid's not participating in learning to read and learning social skills and is getting alienated from their peers, is massive.
We're on the air on Focus with Dr. Craig Sermon talking about ADHD. And Ellie from Champaign is on the line with us now. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you touched on this. I've had experience working with ADD individuals, but this is primarily adults and late teens using various forms of mindfulness and breath meditation as a tool. And I don't know if you want to say more about that. I find that it's been quite successful in many ways for some people.
So when I try to support someone with ADHD, I'm very interested in what you know, I call internal distraction, what's on their mind, what pops up in their mind. And mindfulness techniques are a really wonderful way, and we include them in the book as a way of looking at what is on a person's mind. The idea of mindfulness is that, for example, sitting and noticing the breath and letting your mind come back to focusing on your breathing when your mind wanders, which is one of many techniques like that, you know, allows you to notice thought patterns. There are claims that mindfulness may actually help flex the muscle of mental control as well. However, I think the data on this is still emerging, and it's hard to say, for example, for whom that's true. And I have plenty of patients who tell me, I can't focus well enough to even sit and listen to what you're telling me to do right now. So it's, I do think there's a subset of people who benefit a lot from this kind of noticing their mind and how it wanders and practicing bringing their focus back. One thing that we did in our behavioral therapy study that may be of interest is comparing giving people strategies like using a planner, putting thoughts out of their mind onto paper, you know, having one card table they pull out for projects that just has no clutter on it. These kinds of things we try to coach people in the behavioral therapy studies at Mass General and other places. In the study led by Steve Safran and our research group, we compared it to progressive muscle relaxation, which is tightening and relaxing, you know, parts of the body. And we found that it was better than that. And the reason that was done is you always want some control. You're comparing something to something else. So when you hear claims that something helps, whether it's mindfulness or transcendental meditation or a certain kind of yoga, whatever it is, you want to know, is there strong evidence for this? Now, I also would say there's very little risk of these kinds of techniques. I think they give people a lot of sort of insight into themselves and self-control, and I always recommend them.
I wanted to reinforce that image that you use of almost that the mindfulness is a body-mind muscle development in a sense, and the more you do it, the more the capacity and ability to do it, even if you could only, as you say, can't even sit still for just a few minutes to start with.
I'd agree.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think we have time for one more call in the last couple of minutes. Good morning, Marlene in Urbana. You're on the air on Focus.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I don't know, but I think my husband may have this, but I've been working with him for years. He has a great difficulty organizing, but he can focus wonderfully. He's an engineer. But one thing I was wondering, have there been any correlations between sort of a narcolepsy and this condition also?
We have just about a minute, Dr. Sermon.
So it's really important to look for any cause of problems in function, and there's just so many. I study sleep disorders and how they can look like ADHD, and narcolepsy certainly can look like ADHD. It's also important to look at the patterns of problems that people have or challenges, and we know that about 16% of the population has organizational challenges without having ADHD, but about 30% of people with ADHD have organizational challenges on top of their focus issues, things like what do I do next? You know, how do I juggle multiple demands at once? So our book really helps people think about, you know, what's my set of challenges and what could help me. And it's really critical that people look broadly at the different kinds of options about why could someone be struggling.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to end the discussion there. And Dr. Sermon, I wanted to thank you very much for being on the program with us today and remind people about the book that you've co-authored, Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD or Think You Might, that you've written with Dr. Tim Bilkey and with Karen Weintraub. It's out from Berkeley Books, and it looks like it could be very helpful to a lot of people.
Thank you for getting the information out there. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you again. And chadd.org is the website to go to for the group Children and Adults with ADHD. Dr. Craig Sermon coordinates the Adult ADHD Research Program at Harvard's Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Thank you again for being with us on Focus today. I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. That's Focus numbers 580. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580.